Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Membris Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is Peter Russell, Director of the Town of Silver City Community Development Department, and Peter will be retiring from his position soon, 15 days or so, June 1st. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you before you leave the town. And for the last several months, Peter and I have been working on a project on the natural history of Silver City. And we just completed a Western Institute for Lifelong Learning class that has served as a first cut for compiling ideas, data, stories, maps, photos, and other information on the natural and cultural history of our town. And we asked the questions, what did Silver City look like when Indigenous peoples lived in the area and before Hispanic and Anglo settlement? And what are the factors that shape the present-day landscape of Silver City? And how will climate change influence our environment and, in turn, the plant, animal, and human community in our corner of New Mexico? It's a really fun class, and we're going to share some of the things that we learned in putting the class together with you, our listeners, today. So, Peter, tell us more about this project and the impetus behind it.
Well, the project really started when I saw a book called Manhattan, which is a book about the natural history of New York City. And, of course, New York City is a place enormously transformed from its primeval condition. And the book did a wonderful job displaying that change and also recording the history of the place through old photographs or old drawings or old military maps or old narratives, et cetera. It's a book that won a number of awards, and I thought that it would be really interesting to try and look and apply some of those tools to understanding the past of Silver City and the forces that helped shape it. It's a very beautiful book, and it's certainly beyond the scope of anything that I can do now or that together we have done, but it was an inspiration. The other inspiration for me was a atlas that I saw online that was put together by the Arizona Water Resources Research Committee. Anyway, it's an atlas that's intended, and I'm reading here, to be a repository of information about the natural water and cultural resources of the Upper Gila River watershed. And it would provide a place where people can find information about everything from the basic geography of the region, the geology, the soils, the towns, the roads, and to mapping and tracking changes. And I just thought that would be a wonderful tool to have for Silver City. And so those two documents were the inspiration for approaching you at GRIP to see if we could put together a project that would begin the process of compiling and gathering that information.
And there's a lot of information out there, and it's in a lot of different places. So it was a fun class. We had a two-hour classroom and then two field trips, two Saturdays. So it was great, and lots of wonderful stories, amazing maps. And Peter, I think you, being in the community development department, had access to all these historic maps, the first survey of the town. So very fascinating. So we'll get into some of that. But, you know, I did want to talk about the fact that, you know, this project really was trying to get to the essence of Silver City as place and what makes Silver City what it is. Why does it look the way it is? And you know, what are the factors that influence the landscape? So why is this important? Is this important to us as Silver Cityans?
Well, there's two parts to your question. And so let me try and address the first part and then get to the importance. Silver City is a municipality, so it has a political boundary. And so it's a place on a map that you can point to. But my experience in the planning department, the community development department of the town, is that it's also a focal area for a series of overlying systems that influence the larger area. So, for example, the town's water system goes well beyond the town's limits. It runs east almost to Santa Clara. It goes up to Pinos Altos. It supports Tyrone, etc. So the place is not just the political boundaries, but it's also these systems. And those systems get larger and larger as you look more closely. So, for instance, if you look at the postal system, if you live in the Borough Mountains on the Red Rock Road, your address will be Silver City, say, / Road, Silver City. So that place is even larger than just the water distribution system. If you look at economic distribution systems, you see that people from Cliff come into Silver City to shop. People from Lordsburg come up to the hospital. So it's a much larger system. In fact, the Highway Patrol, Silver City Patrol, goes from the Cliff Dwellings to the top of the Black Range down to Whitewater and White Signal, etc. So Silver City is not just a place, but it's a series of systems that affect an entire area. And I think that's important in trying to understand where this place is and what it does and why it's the way it is. Why this is important, I think, is that if you want to be at home in this place, you really need to understand the particulars of it. You need to know, what are the things you're looking at? Can you name the animals? Where does your water come from? I think that without having those kinds of understandings and a sense of the history, then it's very difficult to feel truly at home in this place. And so my desire is to feel at home where I am and to provide a means for people who already live here or people who are moving here to better know their home.
Absolutely. And we spent a lot of time talking about some of the fundamental processes of our place here in the Southwest and processes that shaped our landscape and the ecology of the area. Maybe we could talk a little bit in very broad brush overview about what some of those processes are.
Sure. Well, we just talked about water and where does our water come from? Well, put simply, the water comes from the sky. It comes as rain. There's a famous book written by a local author in the 50s, I believe it was, called Sky Determines by Ross Calvin. The rain comes because it's caught by the mountains. The mountains, the peaks of the mountains, catch the moist air flowing across them, and the rain drops. And the rain drops on the mountains, and it runs down the arroyos. And the mountains are basically solid, and so the water runs off the mountains. But it runs down to where we are, and it infiltrates into the ground. And there's a large feature here called the Mangus Trench, which runs actually from the Gila River all the way past Hurley. It kind of just opens out into the general alluvial bolson that is the Deming area. And so this rain has been falling for millennia, running down the mountains. It's a phenomenon called mountain front recharge, and it's been stored in the ground. So we live here in part because there's water here, and it's a relatively water-rich area compared to other parts of the state. So I think that a sense of knowing where your water comes from and how the mountains that we live on the edge of influence the deposition of the water into the ground in the geological faults that have been created over time is really important, especially as we try to think about, well, how should we manage our resources? And is there enough water to sustain us and the things that we want to do? And I think that, in fact, there's ample reason to think that there's plenty of resources, water resources.
Right, right. And the geology is important to our area, not only from a water perspective, but also in terms of our economy, right? Geology has influenced mining here.
Right. Exactly. And I think that one of the important features of the geology is the amount of volcanic activity that's occurred in the past, millions of years ago in the past. But what happens with the volcanism as the volcanoes rise or the calderas explode is that all these fractures are created in the surrounding rock, and those become areas for mineral deposition. And, of course, Silver City is initially founded by the European settlers because of that mineral deposition. And people were looking for gold, and people were looking for silver, and here they found silver.
Right, and we're going to get into some of the detail about that in a few minutes. But one of the big questions that we had was, and you know, really required a lot of research, but also imagination, was this the idea of what do we think Silver City looked like before the Europeans came through the region? And we've got a number of accounts that we can go back to, but and really trying to recreate what it looked like, the flora, the fauna. What's your idea?
So it's a really interesting question. In Manhattan, for purposes of looking at before and after, they used the voyage of Henry Hudson up the Hudson River as the first kind of European contact. So that was in the very early 1600s. When you and I started talking about this, we had to try and settle on a date. And it's kind of complicated because there's a long history of Spanish military activities here and exploration and mining. And, of course, there's long occupations by other peoples, Apaches and Mimbrenos. So what I thought would be useful is to look at 1846. That is the date that Stephen Kearny's Army of the West came through this area specifically, and it was on its way to California as part of the Mexican-American War, and it was accompanied by a man named Lieutenant Emery, who was a topographical engineer. And so he wrote some very powerful descriptions of this area, and so in part they're the first descriptions, and I just thought that if we use that as the basis, because after that, a lot of military activity occurred, a lot more exploration occurred, especially with the Boundary Survey following the end of the Mexican-American War, and lots of other explorations were occurring at that time.
Do you want to read what Lieutenant Emery said?
So Lieutenant Emery came through in 1846, and he came through in October. He came through with a military contingent. And they had intended to meet with Mangus Coloradus, who was an Apache chieftain in this area. And they had been camped near the Santa Rita mine, which had been abandoned at that point. And they came through to this place, this spring, where they intended to meet the Apaches. And his description is, "The country passed over in the first part of today was beautiful in the extreme, a succession of high rolling hills with mountains in the distance, the soil rich and waving with grama." He thought he had arrived at the Santa Lucia Spring, but in fact he was here at Ojo de San Vicente, 13.5 miles from the copper mines, very large and impregnated with sulfur, is in a beautiful valley surrounded at the distance of 10 or 15 miles with high mountains. They did not meet the Apaches here. They were in the wrong place. And they later moved on to Santa Lucia, which we now know as Manga Springs, and in fact met the Apaches. But I thought that his description of the place was very appealing. It's a beautiful place, and Silver City was distinctive for its large spring. And I guess one wonders what that spring might have looked like. And that was certainly part of the launching impetus for this project that we worked on together.
So we'll return to that question. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk more about the natural history of Silver City with Peter Russell, outgoing director of the town's Community Development Department. Welcome Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is outgoing director of the Town of Silver City's Community Development Department, Peter Russell. And we've been talking about the natural history of Silver City. And let's talk more about water. Water's on everybody's minds. We've got a big water meeting this afternoon. Water is a defining force here in the arid Southwest, and in prehistoric times, creeks and springs in the Silver City watershed were quite important. And Mimbrus Pit House ruins are located around the area. And Peter, can you describe for us what excavations at these sites tell us about these early peoples? We got a chance to visit a Pit House area on one of our field trips.
Right. Probably I can't. I think this is one of the informational areas that I'm quite interested in, but I think that there is so much opinion about this that it's difficult to say, well, this is the case. This is definitively what happened. I want to make a few observations about it, however. I mean, obviously, the availability of water is instrumental for any peoples to live. And if you didn't have the technologies to tap into groundwater, you were dependent on two other water sources. You were dependent on the rainfall itself and the particular patterns of the rainfall, and you were particularly dependent on surface water flows. So the other observation I want to make is that our interest in history has often been focused on particular aspects of it. So when the first archaeologists began to work here in this area, they were interested in physical anthropology, and they were really interested in gathering skulls from burials and collecting them and comparing them, how they differed and how they might signify relationships among populations. And they often found these bowls over the skulls, and they just throw those aside, and they would take the skull and gather them. Later, archaeologists became quite interested in the bowls themselves because of the imagery, which is quite beautiful and quite distinctive. And so a lot of archaeology has focused on the bowls and the aesthetics of the culture. What I would hope to see made more available to the layperson is the ecology of the native peoples. How did they live, and what did they eat, and how they lived their lives? I know that at the visit to the archaeological site on Ursa Major with Marilyn Markle, she spoke specifically about the bowls and about the fact that they didn't appear to be traded very broadly, that they perhaps were some kind of icon or identifier for the peoples that lived here. What I would hope to see is more information about who they were and what their lives were like. And I think that that's the kind of thing that the atlas could display. You know, their artifacts are really important, but how were their lives shaped as well?
Right. And we know, based on some of the artifacts that were found at that particular location, that they lived up high, but perhaps were doing some small-scale agriculture down in Silver Creek, just below that site. We know that from the metate and manos, the grinding tools, that perhaps they had corn. And, you know, we've seen that at other sites in the area, too. And hunter-gatherer-type lifestyle, based on some of the animal remains that they've found. So yes, very interesting. But here we see at that particular site that this major water source, the Silver Creek, sustained them in that settlement. And how interesting that hundreds of years later, that location was the location of the waterworks building, which supplied the town with water. That's pretty fascinating. Let's talk about that in a couple minutes. But drought seems to have led to the disappearance of the Mimbrus people from the area. And of course, we're having to deal with drought here in our era, in era of climate change. Just sort of wondering if you'd like to comment a bit on drought.
Well, yeah, but let me expand on the idea a little bit. So I said that the water here comes largely from the sky. The water comes from the sky largely in the summertime. We have these monsoonal patterns, and we're all familiar with it. Half the moisture comes in July and August, and then you have a dry period in the spring and dry periods in other parts of the year. There's some more moisture in the winter. So it's a very distinctive pattern, and it's highly variable. If you look at the historical record at Fort Baird, which has 100 years of weather data, the average rainfall there is 15.8 inches, but it's never the average. It's always 22 or 12 or 13. And that is because the monsoons are highly influenced by surface water temperatures of the oceans, whether it's in the Pacific for the Pacific Decadal Oscillation or the El Nino and La Nina phenomenon, or influenced by the Atlantic Decadal Oscillation or Multi-Decadal Oscillation, I guess it is. These are large systems that affect the way rain falls in Silver City. And so when I was talking about silver as a locus of overlying systems, I like to observe that actually the western edge of Silver City is the eastern continental shore of Australia, because those large systems play so much of a role in how we get our water and how variable it becomes. One of the things that archaeologists are looking at now is how that system of reliable rainfall, monsoonal pattern, was dramatically disrupted in the 12th, 13th, 14th century. It really changed a lot. So in addition to perhaps having declining overall rainfall, and they can determine that based on tree wing, dendrochronology, the pattern seems to have changed so that you might get a few large events, and if you're a farming people, it washes out your farms, or the rainfall might be too far in between, and then the crops get started, but they wither. And so it's not just drought in the sense of, gee, there isn't any water. It's the changing patterns. The other thing that potentially led to large population shifts in the Southwest is agriculture was quite successful in the 1000 and 1100, especially in this area. And so populations increased. And so there's the possibility that perhaps the populations outstripped their resources. The Mimbrenos and the Mogollon in general, as I understand it, were specifically highly dependent on hunting and gathering to complement their farming. And so if your game sources decline, the farming may not be enough. What happens is not that everybody dies of hunger or dies of thirst, but the social systems start breaking down. The network of exchange with other community groups begins to break down. Maybe your social order begins to break down. And so people begin to drift and move away. So the drought influence is not just there isn't any water. It's that the stable patterns that people rely on change, and then they have difficulty adapting, especially if they're dependent on just surface flows.
Right, right. So let's sort of flash forward a few hundred years and talk about the Apache. And the Apache were first mentioned by the Portuguese Franciscan missionary Fray Alonso Benavides in his diary in the early 1600s. And Benavides, he set up missions in New Mexico. And we know from historic maps that rivers and springs were important to the Apache. And maybe we could talk a little bit about some of these places that we see from some of these historic maps, like Apache Tejo, and you mentioned Santa Lucia, which now is Mongas Springs, de San Vicente. Let's talk a little bit about these water sources, because they were very important to the Apache, but also to explorers and obviously to the Spanish and Anglo-Americans as they passed through this area and settled this area.
Right. Well, again, I mean, the relationship of water and settlement is, a pretty obvious relationship. I think that what's interesting about the Apaches is how much there is to be told to the larger world and the people here. So often we hear about Apaches in the context of Geronimo or Victorio and the warfare and, you know, the army assaults and attacks. But I think that it does a real disservice to the Apache to not have a better understanding of the cultural context in which they lived and how they moved about. That's the kind of information that I don't know enough about, but that I would certainly like to be see made more available to the general reader. I know that there are specialists in a lot of these disciplines that know a lot, but I think what I would hope through this project that you and I are engaged in is to display that information more widely. You mentioned a couple of locations, and maybe I can talk about them a little bit.
We can talk a little bit. We've got a few more minutes before the break.
Well, one of the ones that you mentioned is Pachitejo, and it's not clear what the source of that word is, but it's a spring that is near the airport along the highway. It's on property that's now owned by the large mining company locally. And it was a kind of a marshy area, and it was well known because it was on the road from the mines at Santa Rita to Janos in Mexico, which was the first presidio that was in charge of administering this area. I'll come back to Pachitejo in a minute. The other spring you mentioned was Santa Lucia, which we call Manga Springs now. It was called Manga Springs because that was a favorite camping site of Mangas Coloradas, who we mentioned earlier. It's a large marshy area with a large bosque associated with it and running water that flows all the way to the Gila River. You can see on old maps that were developed because there was a proposed Indian reservation in that area, little denotations of Indian farms. So people not only lived in it because they could drink the water and feed and water their animals, their horses in particular. They weren't particularly pastoral, as I understand it, but also they could farm along the water. That place is known because of its occupancy by Mangas Colorado. Pachitejo has a sadder component to the Mangas story. There was a military fort briefly there in the 1860s, and Mangas Colorado was captured, taken to that place, and killed. And it's a kind of a sad legacy of that particular spot. But the Apache Mangas Colorado's presence in both places is well established.
All right, so let's take a short break, and we'll talk more to Peter Russell here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is Peter Russell, and Peter's retiring as Director of the Town of Silver City's Community Development Department. And we've been talking about the natural history of Silver City. Let's get back to our discussion about water and the Apache, because I want to finish up that discussion.
Sure. We were talking about Mangas Colorado. I mentioned my interest in having a broader understanding of the Indian presence in this landscape and a few little historical notes. We alluded to a proposed reservation that never really happened. It was withdrawn. The Apaches here were essentially sent off to reservations in Arizona or Oklahoma or in
Florida. Yeah.
But one of the interesting things about the Apaches is they had a very specific interest in place names. It was a very important part of their culture. There's a well-known book called Wisdom Sits in Places. And the Apaches, according to this anthropologist who's done a lot of work with the Western Apache in Arizona, felt that the naming of a place would embed the cultural identity of the people in that particular place. And there were sometimes lessons embedded within the place names or historical events, etc. The idea that Pachitejo might be a legacy word carried over is quite interesting. I think it would be very interesting to try and understand or learn what the Apache place names were for this place, Silver City, Ojo de San Vicente to the Spanish, or what other places might be. And so one of my interests in this project is to try and gather that information so that more people have a better understanding of that history.
Absolutely. I mean, we talked a lot about the fact that in our class that you know, we don't have any Apache names that have survived. I mean, street names or creeks or anything. And folks who grew up back east, you know, all over New England and the East Coast, there are loads of places with indigenous names. But yet we've lost that here. And so this is a huge need to try and do research. So if people have information out there or are fascinated by this question, wouldn't want to get involved, we'll talk a bit about how to get involved at the end of the program. So, Peter, let's just talk about how Silver City may have changed with Anglo-American settlement. You know, we talked a little bit about what it might have looked like from, you know, Lieutenant Emery's accounts, but how did Silver City How is it laid out? The spring, obviously, was an important place. People first came and camped next to the spring and then found silver, and the rest is history. Tell us about that history.
I think that we're talking about water, and I want to talk a little bit later about fire because that's another very important ecological process here. But in terms of water, Emery describes a large spring, somewhat sulfurous, that suggests there was a marsh here. Mining, you know, in this area first started in the Santa Rita area with the Spanish mines going on. When Bartlett came through, the boundary commissioner for settling the boundary between Mexico and the United States after the Mexican-American War, he was accompanied by a lot of people who were interested in what kinds of metals and ores might be available, not just at Santa Rita, but elsewhere. So there was a lot of exploration going on. At the same time, the California discovery of gold in 1848 brought a lot of people moving through this area overland to California rather than taking the long ship voyage around Cape Horn. And so people who were knowledgeable about minerals began moving through this area, and they discovered gold in Pinos Altos in maybe 1859, 1860. And so people began to congregate there. Others started to think about supplying the miners, and they came to this area to farm. But when silver ore was discovered in Ralston, which is now Shakespeare, a number of people from here went there and said, oh, according to the story, if that's silver ore, we know where there's a lot of it. So people came here for the minerals, and the water was incidental to their arrival, but it was important to sustain them here. The surveyors came through to help set up parcels so that you could buy and sell land and so that you could survey your mining claims and control them for yourself and not have others encroach on it. Were very important people in this area that set up the pattern of occupation. So when the first survey occurred here in 1873 so that people could set up lots, they just removed a square mile from the general land office. It was public domain, and they conveyed it to the city government of Silver City, who then sold off parcels. And when they did the survey for the town, they just laid it out in a grid, just the way you would a new town, just the way it's been done so many times in the Midwest and the East. The problem is that the grid was overlaid on top of a watershed that didn't follow a grid. And so when it rained, the water, instead of just kind of surface flowing across the area and through the large sort of flat area that's central Silver City, say from the confluence of the Pinos Altos Creek and the Silver Creek and down to, say, the Broadway Bridge, the water was now running down the streets. And there's dramatic descriptions of water running down the streets in the record, and there are interesting photographs showing the streets totally flooded as well. But what happened is that the flow would be concentrated into the narrow confines of a street, and so it would begin cutting as it ran, because the streets ran straight and they forced the water to run straight and they didn't allow the water to meander, and so the water speed increased and the main street began to erode. And so what was formerly the main street is now the big ditch, and you can see if you cross it on the bridges that have been constructed that in places the incision is 40, 50 feet deep. So the grid layout influenced the way the water ran. In addition to that, the gathering of people, and in 1873 there were already 250 houses in Silver City and 1,000 people, the gathering of people had an influence on the wood resource. All the houses were heated with wood. Everybody cooked with wood. A number of mills had been set up to process ores. Those were all fired with wood. So there was an enormous amount of wood cutting that occurred. And you have to think that that would influence how the capacity of the watershed to absorb the rainfall and to slow the runoff down. In addition, undoubtedly, there was a lot of grazing that would eat the grasses. And because it's so concentrated in a small area, I think that rapidly the watershed began to degrade. So when you add that together with the narrow streets or the narrowing that the streets created, the water flows were quite erosive. And so you dramatically altered the hydrology of the specific area of central downtown by lowering the water table till it hit bedrock and allowing the water to flow downstream.
And at the time, everybody in Silver City was dependent upon groundwater. They had wells. That's what they used for drinking water. So,
right.
But there were a number of efforts to provide a public water supply. I believe we're one of the earliest municipalities in the state to provide a public water supply. But so tell us that story, because that's pretty fascinating too.
The town began to contemplate hiring somebody to develop a public water source. There was a little bit of competition in that. There was a ranching group, Lyons and Campbell. They owned the famous LC Ranch out in the Cliff Hill area that went all the way to the Red Rock and the Arizona border and the uplands. Very large ranch. They were quite interested in developing a water system that could deliver water to their ranching areas in the boroughs. And so they acquired an old mill site right in the bend of the San Vicente Creek, just past where the highway bridge is now, or is temporarily
right
now. And they put in a well that could draw from the creek, and they created a pipeline, and they had a big water tank on top of the Legal Tender Mine, which is on Boston Hill. Their tank was a wooden stave tank. It failed. Water ran down the hill. In the meantime, there was another group that was organizing a municipal water project, and that group focused its work on Silver Creek, where the rock house structure is.
The waterworks building.
The waterworks building, just above the Jose Barrios School. And this is in 1887. So Lyons and Campbell were working in 86. This group, George Utter, in 1887, what they did is they drilled a well that's about 60 feet deep. They ran a long drift or tunnel to the west, 570 feet, I think it is, that went underneath the creek, Silver Creek, and it functioned as an infiltration gallery. And so it filled up, would run water over to the well, and that well would be pumped by steam pumps, steam engines that were fueled by wood initially, later by coal, and eventually by electricity. So the waterworks also had some water tanks on top of the hill right next to it, just on the east side of the Little Walnut Road. And so that infiltration gallery pump house with a rock house where the manager lived because he had to keep the pumps running 24 hours a day. And the storage tank system was the town's first water system that was delivered to the municipality. Over time, it was not sufficient, and the company began looking for wells and exploring water resources up Silver Creek. And there's some wells the town still owns about 3 miles out of town. They began looking at surface water sources. One of them is Allen Springs. It's an inholding in the Gila National Forest, 10 or 15 miles north of town on the other side of the Continental Divide. And so there was a constant effort to find new sources of water. The water sources here are in shallow bearing features, geologic features, and so there was always a limit to how much water was available. In the 40s and 50s, the town began looking south and west to wells on neighboring ranches. Those wells lay within the Mangus Trench feature that I mentioned earlier. They're rich sources of water. The town now owns 4,500 acre-feet of water rights in those areas and has been pumping the deep groundwater for the last 4 or 5 decades. And so we have shifted away from our reliance on these small surface systems, whether it's Allen Springs or the small flows that do come down Silver Creek, and because there's just not enough water stored in those particular features. But south of town in the Mangus Trench, there's a lot of water stored.
15 million acre feet, I believe. All right, let's take a short break and we'll talk more to Peter Russell here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, and I'm your host for today's program. We're going to continue talking with Peter Russell, director of the Town of Silver City Community Development Department. Peter will be retiring soon from the town, and we've been talking about the natural history of Silver City. In our remaining 10 minutes or so, let's talk about wildfire. This has been an important natural force that influences the ecology of our area. Give us a little background on wildfire.
The flora where we live is a fire-adapted system. It burns regularly. And in some instances, the health of, say, the ponderosa pine forest is dependent on fire to keep an open forest that burns through invading plants and keeps a large size of tree because those are resistant to the fire. Different plant communities have different fire regimes. And so some places burn regularly. Almost every year. Some burn, say, every 10 or 15 years, and it depends on the composition of plants, whether it's chaparral or woodland or ponderosa pine forest. Some forest burns very irregularly, and when it does, it can be stand replacing. So, for instance, the spruce fir forests on the mountaintops, when they burn to the ground. So all these systems are naturally functioning, except that over time, because with management, we have suppressed fires wherever we see them, the fuel load has increased over time. And so the systems are fire dependent, but they're out of whack and very vulnerable to very intense fires. That's a problem not only for the natural systems, but it's also a problem for the built environment. And for 100 years, the solution has been to put out the fires to protect the structures. Now people are beginning to focus on, well, what can we do to protect the structures? And so simple ideas are to not have flammable roofs or to cut back the vegetation that's adjacent to your house or to, if you have propane tanks, ensure that the tank nozzle is pointed away from your house, or don't stack tires against your house. I mean, there's a series of things that people can do, and the Silver City Fire Department or the volunteer fire departments can easily tell you what things you might do to fireproof your home. But rather than try to suppress all fires, which in any case is really not feasible anymore, it's much better, especially if you live in the urban wildland interface, to try and create a defensible space around your home that protects you. The large-scale fires that we have been seeing in coming years will undoubtedly continue because of change, not only in the piling up of the fuels, but also in the change that's happening with the climate. So one of the things that's clearly happening is that temperatures are slowly increasing. And with the increase in temperatures, fires become more frequent because things dry out more quickly and they dry out more dry. And the fires become larger and they last longer. And so that is probably a trajectory that isn't very alterable. And so we're just going to have to live with it as best we can. The other thing that's happening is that while it's uncertain whether precipitation total amounts is going to fall, it's clear that the way the precipitation comes is changing. The variability that I mentioned before, that's on part of the Fort Baird record, it will probably increase in variability. There will be bigger rains less often and drier periods perhaps more often. And of course, that affects how quickly things dry out. The other thing that changes is that if you're dependent on snowpack for your runoff on the rivers and the snowpack melts, or it just kind of evaporates in the air because of the heat, then you have a real problem managing the flows. They might be coming down bigger and earlier and finishing sooner. And so if you're dependent on irrigated farming, that can be a problem. If you're depending on groundwater, it's much less of a problem because the ground is very unperturbed by the variation from year to year of the rainfall, so long as the trajectory of total amounts remains the same. Falls on the mountains, runs down the arroyos, sinks into the Bolson or the Mangus Trench.
Right. So what can we do to better adapt to these changes, especially in the area of water? I mean, the town has a water conservation plan, and what things can we be doing to build resiliency, not only in our built environments, but also in our natural systems?
Well, that's a complicated question. And I think that one of the interesting things that we have learned, you and I, as we went through this, is how simple little elements of our ecology or our landscape become complex quite rapidly. I think that we already talked about some of the things you can do to defend your home. I think that in terms of water, conservation is a really good practice, and outdoor watering is a particular problem for the town. Right now, we are able to benefit from indoor water use because we have a return flow credit from water that comes out of the sewer plant and goes into the ground. That's a new 750-acre-foot water credit the town received just this last year. But in terms of outdoor watering, people should be looking at maybe planting species that are adapted to much drier conditions, ideally native species, but certainly species that are well adapted. People might think about how to maybe use the public resources of parks and things like that more often, rather than trying to have all of their green environment specifically around their home themselves.
Right. So, Peter, as we wrap up our show today, you mentioned earlier that this is an ongoing project. What's your vision for how this project will continue?
So my thought was, A, to build a catalog, an atlas of these things that shows them graphically, you know, these things that we've been talking about. But I think that it's something that's dependent on other people coming forward with information they have or questions that they have, and compiling those questions so that they can be presented to experts, say, to answer. I don't present myself as an expert in this case. I'm much more interested in being a facilitator that helps gather the information, gathers the questions, and seeks the answers in common. So I'm hoping that an online resource might be established, perhaps through GRIP, where people could begin to contribute ideas. I think images, photographs, narratives would be really useful. One of the things that I'm really interested in seeing is some kind of inventory of local organizations that can help people better understand these questions of what are the natural systems? What are these birds I'm looking at? What are these rocks? How do they get made? There's a number of organizations like the Audubon Society or the Rolling Stones organization. There's all these groups that have this information, and how can we guide people towards those groups so that they can become engaged in learning these things about the particulars of their place so that they can be in home here? How can they be engaged in learning not just through books but through experience?
Well, Peter, it's been a pleasure working with you on this project. It's been a terrific project, great learning experience. I'm really excited about moving forward with it, and I really appreciate your time and speaking with us today here on Earth Matters. And let's see, for more information on how you can get involved with the Natural History of Silver City project or for a podcast of today's program, visit Earth Matters online at www.gmcr.org. That's all the time we have today. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM.